Over the Mall is brought to you by Soccer America. Soccer America, the soccer paper of record. Go to socceramerica.com and sign up for your subscription today. More information on all our sponsors at overtheball.com/sponsors.
Hey, this is Bob Lee, and you're listening to Over the Ball with Kevin Flynn, the world's game from an American perspective.
Welcome to Over the Ball with Kevin Flynn, along with Dave Gallego, the show that talks about the world's game, but from an American perspective. Well, Davey G, I am back, my God, from a five-week kick-ass road trip, Antarctica, Patagonia, all the way to Palm Beach. Have you spent any time in Palm Beach, Dave?
Just a little bit. No, welcome back. Welcome back to the real world, huh?
Well, I was going to say, Palm Beach, oh my God, it is the greatest people-watching town in the world. It was just absolutely unbelievable to just watch people, late hundreds, driving Ferraris. It's amazing. So we had our Stand Up and Learn fundraiser there for the kids program that I run. And we had Jackie Flynn, who plays Tony on Loudermilk. I don't know if you've been watching Loudermilk, but it's been a big hit.
I gave it a shot. My wife and I gave it a shot. I love how, I alluded to that one time you did Nantucket, you did West Palm Beach. So again, you're really getting into the inner cities and helping the underprivileged.
It's all about the kids. No, actually, it's free for the year-round kids and everybody. But yeah, we had Jackie Flinney's and Loudermilk. We had Don Gavin, the godfather of Boston comedy, and a Philly comic named Jimmy Schuber, who just was hysterical, so irreverent. So anyway, so today... I'm really excited about this guest, Dave. I know you are too. This is when we, you know, really sort of jumped into this game and became passionate about it. Rick Davis will be our guest today. And boy, I'm telling you something. I said it on the show the other week when we were, you know, teasing this show. I had that man's poster on my wall, along with Cheryl Teagues and Farrah Fawcett. So he was in some high company there, but it was
we call that a Ricky Davis sandwich.
He's like, well, maybe we'll talk to him. He was with the Cosmos. It could have happened. They were the talk of the town in New York City. So, but I couldn't imagine the pressure that young man had. I mean, 18, 19 years old, being dropped into New York City with these, huge international soccer stars. And he had to just make do. So it will be great to talk to him about the Cosmos and what he's been up to since. I know he was the chairman of AYSO for a while, and really excited to talk to him. And like I said, when we were talking to John Harkes, Dave, young people forget the history that's come before them. These guys are trailblazers. You know, you talk about Harksy going over to the Premier League. Yeah, it was tough. Or Landon Donovan going to Germany. Yeah, it was tough. But I think what Ricky Davis did was absolutely bigger. It really was. It just he put America it put a face on American soccer for me as a kid, and so I'll forever be in his debt.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And there's so much I want to talk to him about because, like you say, going from college and then right to the Cosmos, where it's just who's who of soccer gods. I can't wait to hear his reaction to that and some of the great stories that he has to tell.
Yeah, and I don't even think he finished college. I mean, he went early. They pulled him out early. And so he wound up captaining the World Cup team, which at times was rather chaotic. And they hadn't qualified for the World Cup in a long, long time. So all kinds of stories. I remember one with, there was a qualifier and Steve Moyers, boom, boom, bam, bam, Moyers didn't have his passport. Like players didn't know. It was just kind of on another level back then. So
in 86, I think he netted two goals against Costa Rica during qualifying. And they eventually did not make it, of course. But it was exciting in 86.
Yeah, my father, who knew nothing about the game, basically said, "Well, Kevin, how can we lose to Costa Rica?" And I said, "Dad, the best 11 athletes in that country are on that team, and they're passionate about the game, and so this is the way it works." In America, finally, maybe we're catching up and passing some of these countries in a lot of ways. So,
speaking of passing countries, although we've never really had to pass anybody with women's soccer, let's talk about the ladies and how they came back strong and beat Colombia.
Yeah, Davey, I went hard at the women last week. I think they do need a kick in the ass, and it seems like some of the players, jumped up and answered. Look, if you have it too easy for too long, you get a little soft. And so I love the fact that these young players are starting to come up full of piss and vinegar and just sort of pushing the older players. And they came out and came out fired up.
Well, you said it. Yeah, the U.S. had toughness and the skills to win a punchy match against Colombia. I mean, Colombia was trying to really give it to them. They tried to turn it into a dogfight, and the United States saw past the head games, and like you just said, they had the toughness, and it was a good match. Good for them. It was a nice comeback in terms of the resiliency from their prior loss.
Look, when everybody shoots for you, that's going to happen. People are going to get chippy because they're trying to, you know, dethrone you, basically. And the women have to answer that. There's, you know, we both play the game. There's no way to get around that. When a game gets physical, you got to match it.
Yep, and we did a great job. I have to commend them. It was a good match to watch, and it was a great follow-up. I'm very, very proud of them.
Good. So we're happy the women stepped up in that regard. And it'll be a long road, though, as well. So they're rebuilding.
They have Canada. Canada's not going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah. No, they never are. I mean, the whole region has gotten better. So it's been interesting. And then some great Premier League action this week. I know the Man City, Man United game, and then the Liverpool game was fantastic. It ended at the they scored a goal, like, you know, like maybe 10 seconds before the whistle blew.
Yeah, but, you know, that derby, that Man City, Man U game, that was great. Now, Man U had them 1-0 in the first half, and then Man City just took over. And I tell you what, I don't know if you saw the game, but two of the goals were absolute lasers. Definitely worthy of pulling the highlights up from YouTube. I mean, like, just ridiculous, ridiculous shots.
That's great, the level people are playing at. But, you know, look, I think this is always the game where people come out to play a Man City or a Liverpool, and you just sort of keep compact, stay organized, try to withstand the pressure. But everything always breaks down in the second half. So Liverpool's still at the top of the table. Man City just, you know, nipping at their heels. So I like when it's a dogfight and it's not, you know, one team just running away.
Me too.
Yeah, I always like when it's a race at the end during the Premier League. So there certainly is a race now with Man City nipping at the heels of Liverpool. So, all right. So let's take a break here real quick. And when we come back, we'll be joined by one of my childhood idols, Rick Davis. You're listening to Over the Ball. All right, we are back on OTB. Dave, I know you're excited about our next guest, as am I. A couple of weeks ago, we had John Harkes on, a former captain of the U.S. men's national team. I want people to remember these names. You know, we talked about John going over playing in the Premier League. We talked about Landon Donovan going to Germany. Nobody, I feel, had a tougher road to toe than this next man, Rick Davis. Welcome to Over the Ball, my friend. How are you?
Hey, Rick.
Doing good, guys. Doing good.
So before you got on, Rick, I was saying there were three posters on my wall when I was in junior high school, and it was Cheryl Teagues, Farrah Fawcett, and Rick Davis. So you were
oh, man. Good company. I was the one that you threw the darts at, the other ones you looked at, right?
They were the two sides of my life that I aspired to. So I just have to say, you know, thinking about what you did for the American game, you inspired me as a young player to say, okay, that's an American guy who is out there doing it, and so it's possible for a player like myself to shoot for that. And before you got on, Dave and I were just talking about what a difficult thing it must have been to just leave college and go to New York City and play for the Cosmos. I mean, talk about that first. I know everybody wants you to talk about the Cosmos, but tell it. What 19 years old? I think you were.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not talk about the Cosmos? I mean, you go, like, you know, like Kev said, you go from Santa Clara University, you plucked out early, and now you're going to a team where everywhere you look, you have Beckenbauer, Carlos Alberto, Dennis Tewart, Canalia, Cruyff. You got to tell us all about it. I mean, who taught you the most? Tell us about your first practice.
Wow.
Inquiring minds want to know.
So this is a big question with lots of answers to it. So let's start off with the college part. I actually was recruited to go to the Tampa Bay Rowdies by the coach then, a gentleman by the name of Eddie Firmani.
Oh, yeah.
And, the Cosmos coach. Yeah. He actually had seen me at a training camp for the youth team, which was down in Florida. And so they brought me in, and, you know, and they really did it right. They flew my parents in because the big thing was how I was going to complete my education and all of that.
It was a real recruiting pitch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so ultimately it was, you know, I've got dad was a doctor, mom was a nurse. So I come from a family that's really big into education. And I remember when I told my dad, hey, you know, I really would like to, you know, become a soccer player. And he looked over at my mom and said, Marty, where'd we go wrong? And, you know, he did it jokingly. But anyway, so Eddie Fermani makes the move to the Cosmos. He stays in touch with me. And the freshman year at Santa Clara was a little, I don't know, underwhelming for me, because not only was it only 3 months, but the competition just, you know, wasn't what I believed there would be.
And now, of course, let me ask you, Rick, there. So before going there, what competition were you playing in? Like, just were you playing for foreign teams or what was it?
No, actually, I was playing just with a club team, a team out of Fountain Valley. I don't know if you know the name Derek Lawther. Derek was very connected within U.S. soccer circles, within the coaching department. And he was actually the coach of this team called the Fountain Valley Eagles, which is, you know, in the area that I grew up in Southern California. And right. And so I was playing with him prior to, you know, going off to college. Go off to college. And, you know, and again, that's where the connection with Eddie Fermani, Ray Klavecka, who was the youth Cosmos team coach.
Yeah. And eventually the Cosmos coach.
And became coach of the Cosmos. So Ray was one of the two coaches with the U.S. youth team, the under-19 team. And I was selected for that. And that's, again, where I think that connection came between he, Eddie Fermani, and myself. And so anyway, long story short, so I remember sitting down with Eddie and with Ray, and they said, okay, here's what we'd like to do. We'd like to have you come and join the team. You know some of our players, you know, Pelé, Beckenbauer, Giorgio Canaglia, Vladislav Bogusevich, Johan Naiskens. I mean, all these guys that I grew up idolizing or watching. And they said, and we'd like to pay you, and we'd like to, you know, go ahead and, you know, give you a house. And then, you know, living accommodations, all that, you know, how does that sound? And I'm like, what, are you kidding me? You know, how could it not sound better? And so, yeah, the draw to leave school was a big one, because I looked at it as this was my chance. And what better way to find out whether you got what it takes than to go to a team that has all these great players and find out right away.
So, you know, the part of that is like, you don't want to be like just a token there, you know, the American guy that they pull in. But there was part of that there. And I think what that does is create an amazing amount of pressure on a player to say, you are the American player that is representing the young players of America, which you did for me. But it must have been a lonely, you know, sort of stepping on that pitch sometimes with the level of play that you had to eventually try and catch up to.
Well, it was, and no doubt the, you know, the American rule where they're, you know, required to have three North Americans, which, you know, included Canada.
Yes.
And so, you know, it obviously was, I think, something that helped. In my case, the thing that really maybe was different for me than a lot of other guys is I felt like I was embraced by my teammates, you know, in particular. And this, you'd asked me earlier about the, you know, the guy that really was most significant. It was Franz Beckenbauer.
Yeah.
He and I, two very different players. He's very graceful, very controlled. And, you know, and I looked at myself and still think that, you know, I'm a grunter. I'm a, you know, I'm a guy that goes out there and does more, you know, defensive type of things than offensive type of stuff.
We're a big team worker. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and that was it. And so I think that, you know, you start talking about the notion of all these stars aligning. They did, you know, Franz embraced and, you know, kind of took me under his wing, was very, very helpful, as were the other guys. But, you know, I think
Canaglia must have beat you up a little bit, though. He was a tough guy behind the scenes.
Oh, he was. Yeah, he was. He was. You know, Giorgio was one of those guys where if he was scoring goals, he was happy. So it's, you know, like the happy wife, happy life kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the team was happy when Giorgio was happy. You know, the team wasn't so happy when he wasn't happy. And, you know, and you know, that's what made him, I think, the goal scorer that he was. But yeah, Giorgio put me through the rings several times. In fact, there was one particular incident. We were on a bus. And, he literally came back and, you know, and grabbed me by the shirt and pinned me up against the, you know, the windows of the bus. and, you know, and said, you know, you better, you know, do what you need to do to be a part of this team. And, you know, and it was sort of like, oh, wow.
He was a big boy, too.
Absolutely.
I went to his soccer camps, and he was, what, maybe 6'2", but wiry and had ill-tempered.
Absolutely. I mean, he grabbed them by the shirt. I mean, so Ricky, tell us your first impression. I mean, when did it sink in that you're actually playing amongst these soccer gods? When did it sink in? Because when you first saw all this, you must have been pinching yourself and being like, this really can't be happening.
Yeah, it started when I walked into the locker room at Giant Stadium. And, I knew really nothing about that sort of environment. I remember walking into the locker room and we were sharing the stadium, of course, with the Giants the football Giants, that is. And so when I walked into the locker room, I remember going down the little, the corridor, and you looked into the various, little parts of it, and there were name plates above all the different lockers. Yeah. And so I remember looking at, the first one was Giorgio Canaglia. The next one was Franz Beckenbauer. The next one was Johan Naiskens. So, and so I'm looking at these, I'm like, oh, wow, how awesome is this? And I remember there was this one that said Rick Davis. And I'm like, Rick Davis, who is that? kind of a thing. And then it was like, oh, wow, wait a minute. Yeah. And so that was really the first moment where not only did that make me feel like I was, where I wanted to be, but I think more than anything else, it kind of inspired me more. It made me say, hey, if I'm going to be here, I've got to earn my keep. And that's how I approached it.
I think, Rick, two things were happening for you there. One is, what, you're 18 or 19 years old at this point?
I would have been 18 at that time.
Yeah, so you're 18 years old. I don't think you know any better. And I think the other thing is you don't know really the amazing situation you're stepping into. You can't really process that completely. Right. And the other thing is we didn't know a lot of these players, because there wasn't any television that we could watch. There wasn't any publications that we could get. So, when I started to meet these guys later, I sort of didn't really, like, I'm like, Naiskens? Who's Naiskens? And then I kind of started those orange shirts and everything. So, I have a friend who's an actor, a very successful actor, and she says that sometimes an 18-year-old kid will walk into an audition with Robert De Niro, and they're like, hey, oh, yeah, that's that guy from the they don't quite know. And I think that part of it was what you had, where hey, this is cool.
Yeah. I think a lot what helped me is that, when I was growing up in Southern California, we had an Englishman in the town that we lived in. Claremont was the name of it. And he was a, absolutely huge English soccer guy. In fact, to him, there was no other country that had any worthwhile soccer programs. England, exactly. Yeah. I know a lot of people like that today.
Yes,
and so exactly. Anyway, he was really inspirational as a first coach, because, he inspired us about the game. He said, hey, these are the things that you need to know how to do. And, and look at how these guys, and he talked about a lot of the players. So we started to hear and know some of these names when we were 7 or 8 years old. Go from there. My next coach is a German immigrant. And Dieter Damier was his name. And Dieter, he was big into the disciplines within the sport. He talked about how a waste of, South America was entirely, because they all just played fancy stuff and none of that was any good. You have to be disciplined. You have to be structured. You have to, again, right on down the line. And so we learned that element of the game. So now my next coach is an Italian immigrant. And so anyway, the point being is that I had all of these coaches who not only created, an inspiration to me, you talk about knowing some of these names, I would have never known any of this stuff if I had grown up, without them, but with their influence in my life, I was a soccer junkie at 7 years old.
That's amazing. So, and I think you're really fortunate, Dave.
And Ricky, I have to tell you that I was 8, 9 years old when you came up, and my dad's from Spain, so he knew the arsenal of names. He knew everybody, and I didn't, to Kevin's point. And then, of course, I quickly learned about everybody. And anyway, my father would be so pleased with his Spanish accent. Ricky Davis, Ricky Davis. He was so proud of the American player on the Cosmos. So getting back to my earlier question, just circling back because it's fascinating. You said that Beckenbauer kind of took you under his wing. What was something that any of those legends in the locker room taught you? Is there something that comes to mind right off the bat?
Well, the thing with Franz, and again, if people have the opportunity to see any videos or, you know, whatever of our games, if you watch...
This is my father with Franz, by the way. Sorry.
There you go.
Our listeners can't see this, of course, but it's so Ricky. Ricky.
Dave. All right.
That's pretty awesome. So what ends up happening?
Zone, but it doesn't matter. So
That's right. So in games, literally, you know, in a game, if people will, you know, look at videos of the games or whatever, or those that maybe were in Giant Stadium, there was an ongoing dialogue between Franz and myself, and it was an education. It was no different than having a tutor sitting down next to a student, you know, going over some sort of, you know, academic thing, and having that tutor there to ask questions, to have them say, you know, that's not quite the direction or whatever. And that's what Franz did with me. And I didn't ask for it. I remember, he offered it to, you know, was that way with a number of other players. But unfortunately, their, you know, attitudes were in the wrong place. You know, they're like, oh, you know, I don't need somebody telling me what I need to do. I'm on this team and blah, blah, blah. And me, it was like, hey, I'll soak it up. You know, tell me everything and anything that you want. And so literally, I would make a run. I would make a pass. I would, you know, do something. And, you know, sometimes it had to wait because obviously you couldn't just stop the game right there. But Franz would say, hey, you know, blah, you know, maybe you should try it this way. Or did you think of that? Or excellent, or, you know, whatever. And so it was both inspiring but also educational.
All right, so I want to make a point of that, of this, of what you, Rick Davis, just said to any young player out there listening. You do not have the answers. You're learning. You should be like a sponge. And here's a player that stepped into a situation. You had the athletic ability, obviously. You had the desire. That's generally not enough. What you need to do is listen to your elders, to those who come before you and have all this experience. And what greater teacher than Franz Beckenbauer? You know, I always tell the story. I learned how to overlap, when to overlap, by a coach named Bob DeCranian from Southern Connecticut. And he was refereeing at the time. And he would just say, no, now. Like, needed that. So that's a bad Rick. So
that's awesome.
And the youth. You must sort of look at the game a little differently now. You were also, you know, you ran AYSO for a while. Talk mm-hmm. about that experience, and then talk about where you see the youth today. Because, like, I, like you, played seven sports. We played everything, and that was the American experience. And I think soccer's a bit of a game of the streets a little bit, but you also maybe were burning some of these kids out. But I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the thing that, you know, that we look at with kids and you know, the stories I share with people is that over the years, or, you know, quite a bit, actually, when I was with the Cosmos, because one of the other things that I enjoyed were the fans. You know, instead of, like, separating myself from them, I enjoyed them. I would do things with them, and there were fan clubs, you know, the Cosmos fan club. I even had my own fan club, if you can believe that, for a while. So I would go to these, events, and, you know, the big thing was first of all, to have there be a desire. A lot of times, you know, parents and or people think that somebody, you know, should and, you know, will do something because they think it will be the right thing for them. Well, my big thing is, you know, if you have a kid who isn't driven in sports, who isn't, you know, one that goes out there and really, you know, wants to work, you know, isn't, you know, coordinated or whatever, well, don't try and make them into a professional athlete. Well, you know, guide them in something else that they're interested in. But the big thing is, you know, does a child actually want, you know, want to do that? The next thing is, are they willing to, you know, do what it takes? And there's all kinds of, you know, cliche type expressions or whatever. But a big story that I remember hearing when I was growing up was about how a person who was wanting to do something, and when all of his friends would go out and play and do whatever stuff, he would stay continually working on you know, the thing that he wanted to do. Well, right. Some number of years later, he made it and they didn't. And so, you know, it's that type of thing. You know, you want to make sure that the child is really driven by it. And the big thing is make sure that they're having fun. Therein lies the big rub that we have right now, is that the sport has evolved in a vacuum. And that vacuum, from my perspective, is the absence of, you know, structure and you know, and people that are really educated. Yeah, we've learned a lot. I still continue to feel like I'm learning the game, but culturally, America still is, you know, fully there. Yeah. And so, you know, the big thing is it's, you know, you can't necessarily say that it's ingrained in our blood. You know, we're getting close, but not quite there. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, people get pretty bizarre perceptions, I think, of what ultimately, you know, that somebody should do. And what I mean by that in plain terms is, parents, let your kids tell you what they want to do. Don't you force them or try to tell them. And so you've got all of these clubs that are out there where you can spend a near fortune on, you know, on developing someone. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, my thing is are they really looking out after the best interests of the kids, or are they looking at it as, hey, we want to be the club that developed Landon Donovan, or that you know, that got, you know, Christian Pulisic into you know, the quality player that he is, or whatever it might be.
Or parental ego. I have noticed. I battled that a lot. If people knew that I was a professional player, they would start to say, "Well, my son, you know, he's on the traveling state the B team. You know, is going to go pro." And I'm like, you can tell the kid's not doesn't have it, but like, let him go on his own journey. You know, a lot of these parents, they go to every single practice. I tell the story about Dave Mazur. He's the head coach, you know, in New York. What's the team there? St. John's. He said to me, he went to recruit a kid, Rick, and the kid started to yell at his mother that she forgot his roller that he needed to stretch out with. And he said, he's yelling at his mother about not bringing the roller. And he goes, I don't want that kid on my team. But what I gleaned from your story, though, Rick, and reading about it is, you decided, and this is what parents don't understand, there was something in you that said, "Mom, Dad, I want to be a professional athlete." Yeah. And that's one thing to say it, and then there's the other thing to back it up with the hard work and the passion and the perseverance that your parents have nothing to do with.
You know? Yeah. Well, their role were the genes. Somewhere within, you know, the you know, that makeup, you know, there's something, because, you know, at the end of the day, I look at, you know, my wife and I, we have 7 kids.
Whoa.
And oh, every goodness. One
Ricky
of them,
Davis, Ricky.
Something else that I did pretty well.
You have more kids than they scored goals.
But, you know, for each of them, and you know, in a you know, a story that I like to share with people is with one of our daughters. I was going with her because she was looking at going to college, and she was a pretty decent soccer player, not, you know, and really anything to do with me, just on her own. And I remember that, you know, we were getting close to this school, and she kind of had a woeful look about her. And I said, "Hey, Leanne, you know, what's up?" And she says, "Well," she says, "I'm worried that I'm going to disappoint you." And I said, "You know, what do you mean?" And she says, "Well, you know, we're going to talk to the coach of the soccer team here, and, you know, and, you know, they're going to maybe want me to play soccer. And my interest is in, you know, in other things. I mean, I love playing the game, but I don't want to play at college. I want to go to school or whatever." And I started to cry.
Yeah.
I said, "Where on earth did I ever give you the impression that, you know, I had something in my mind that said, you know, you needed to do this?" I said, it's what you want to do, Leanne. I want you to get an education. Yeah, that much is true. But, you know, whether you play soccer or whether you, you know, become an actor or an actress, whether you become a, you know, a street cleaner, that's whatever you want to do.
Someone told me the quote, and it's really true with my daughter as well, because Rick, I cry all the time thinking, well, you could have done something better. And, you know, we want so much for these kids.
Shame on our daughters for doing that to us, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah. It does tug our hearts. But your parents are happy when you're happy. So kids have to find their own way. And so it's great. You know, I want to bring up something else. You know, Paul Gardner, is at Soccer America. I used to just laugh my ass off when you two would go at it on broadcasts where he had that old, you know, that sort of self, I love Paul, but he had that self-righteous sort of English, you know nothing, young man, please. And you'd come back at him, and I'm like, that's a midfielder, man. That's a midfielder. He's going back at him.
You want to know what a funny thing about that is during the broadcast, he and I, we're actually on air, we're broadcasting the game, and we've got, you know, headphones on, and the, you know, the director's talking. Paul would say something, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get into it, but apparently I must have, like, frowned or whatever. And so the producer, the director would get in my ear, and he'd say, Rick, you're not just going to let him say that, are you?
Oh, God.
So he's, like, spawning me on. It's like as if I needed, somebody to get me. But, I love Paul because of, you know, his perspective, but he was just always cynical, it seemed to me. And, that's where some of our disagreements came.
Go ahead, Kevin.
You said, get the ball out, cross it. And the kid guy really should cross the ball. He goes, oh, no coaching from the sidelines. No coaching. And they're on air. It was hysterical.
Yeah. So, Rick, speaking of broadcasting, Rick, so you're very involved with the MLS and the LA Galaxy in particular. I think you're one of the commentators over there. Is that correct?
Not as a stand-on, but as an as-needed basis.
Okay, so let me ask you something. So if you could transplant one thing that exists within the MLS today and have had it in the old NASL, what would it be? What would have made the NASL more successful for a longer period of time?
I think it's the business model that MLS has created. And if we go back to, 95, 96, when MLS was forming or being formed, and I was a part of the evaluation crew that looked at the ideas, and there were really three different entities at the time that wanted to become the first division league, and MLS had their model of the so-called single entity approach, and for me that was that's not American. It's like you can't in certain ways work around the laws where you restrict literally free opportunity, but I was actually a pretty adamant opponent to MLS and their proposal, and here we are, what is it now, 20-25 years later, and thank goodness that they didn't listen to me and they ended up going the route that they did, because it has created stability. Both, from an ownership perspective, but also, on the field a little bit. You don't have, one team that runs away, with the, the championship every year, or, to some degree, sort of what the Cosmos did, where nobody could keep up with them. So I think that, that would be it.
So if you had to pinpoint one specific thing out of their business model, though, what would it be? Just one thing. Would it be soccer-specific stadiums?
It would.
Didn't know there was going to be a quiz, Davis, did you?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, holy cow. I would say, stadiums would probably be it. Having, teams that have their own homes. I mean, some of the teams that you were talking about over, in England, or, for that matter, in Italy, because, I started off with the Cosmos. They sent me to Italy. And so there is really only one team in, in the Serie A, and that's Milan. And not the Inter one. I listen to people talk about, English soccer. And again, you look at all of these teams, their stadiums are it's kind of like, what's the Wrigley Field in Chicago?
Yeah, you're right on the field.
How do you not think of baseball when you hear, Wrigley Field? How do you, not think of tennis when somebody says, Wembley or whatever? So soccer, didn't have that. And I think that would have been a big help.
Well, we had Willie Roy on a few weeks ago, and it's funny. He still harbors resentment towards the Cosmos. It's every time I bring up their name, I could see him wincing and gritting his teeth. But all right, so let me ask you, Conversely, what do you think led to the downfall of the NASL? And I'll tell you what he said first, and you can offer your comments. He said it was with the advent of indoor soccer, you guys wanted to compete against the MISL. There were some big crowds initially, and then they wanted to expand the number of games, and they weren't able to get attractive days, so they ended up having to play on like Tuesday nights, and that basically fizzled. He actually blames the indoor league as to why the NASL is no longer.
Hey, blame me.
Yeah, I you know, obviously think that there were some issues with that, but for me, the NASL was already in a downward spiral before the indoor league came along. In fact, you know, if you look at my career, you know, what was the reason at the end of the day for why Rick Davis left the Cosmos? Because I didn't go to Team America.
I wanted to ask you about that too. You went to the Steamers.
Yeah, and so, you know, the whole Team America thing, that was rough to say no to that, but it was my loyalty to the Cosmos and what they had provided and or given me. And and the dilemma was that, you know, the financially, teams couldn't compete. You know, the Cosmos were, you know, too strong and had, you know, kind of an unlimited bucket of money because Warner Communications, Steve Ross, this little company called Atari was coming along, you know, right at that time. And so I think that it was, you know, just the inability to control kind of egos and or the way people spent, because absolutely there was no financial consideration for what the Cosmos did. And thank goodness that, you know, it worked for as many years as it did. But ultimately, you know, that was for me the demise of the league, is that there was, you know, the haves and the haves not have nots. Is that how you say that?
You know, that's so, you know, Willie Roy was basically saying, don't forget the sting. And it, and I think you can.
Yeah.
I gotta say, Rick, I remember being, I think in college when you went through that, and I was working at the Cosmos soccer camp in the summer. So I kind of, you know, knew some of the inner workings, and I saw both sides of what you were going through, and I totally understood your decision. And what was interesting was I was in the locker room, standing next to Miguel de Lima. You remember Miguel from,
all these names, man, you know, all these people, I'm telling you, this is awesome.
I'm standing next to Miguel, and, the New York Post came out with some bad comments that Jeff Durgan made about the Cosmos, you know, cause he was a wild man. And such a hot-headed guy, too. You know, I played against him, took a couple of elbows from the boy. But
he played for the Cosmos at one point.
Oh, yeah. Durgan played with Rick. You know, with Rick. So,
yeah, Jeff did.
But Jeff went to the Team America, and Team Rick America didn't. So I'm in there, and Miguel can't. He asks me to read what Jeff Durgan said. And I'm like, I suddenly couldn't read. I suddenly had dyslexia. Jesus. It was some wild times, you know, and we played, you know, I was on the U.S., what was it, one of the teams. We played Team America at, you know, RFA, and I ran into Mooch Marinick with an elbow. Oh, my God, I think I'm still hurting from that thing. And he was one of the guys that had a real problem with what you had done, because there was a real feeling of American players got screwed, and they did. We got screwed over and over, and even when we were talking about you had to have four North Americans, they were green card guys that hadn't spent 2 days in America generally most of the time. So it put a chip on our shoulders. It really did.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't just the notion of the, you know, the green card players or whatever. It was the fact that they weren't any better than, you know, than the American or the North American kids that, you know, that were interested in and available. And, you know, and so there really wasn't that, you know, that commitment to the development of the sport. It was a matter of, okay, who can we get for, you know, less money or whatever that's got a you know, a better track record.
And half the time it was the coach's friends that were playing Division II or III in England. Then they'd come over here. And the least understanding players that I played with and coaches were the English guys, because they just didn't understand, you know, how we grew up playing 6-7 sports, going to college. It's just it's a totally different mindset for them. So anyway, so what are you up to now, Rick, and where are you living?
What we call the heartland of America. We are absolutely, if you took a dart and somebody put a map of the United States in front of you and, you know, nothing written on it, and they said, okay, we want you to try to hit dead center of the United States. That's where we are. We're in Ellsworth, Kansas, a town of 2,000 people. You know, we moved here 23 years ago, mostly to just be in a better place with our kids, you know, in terms of, you know, getting out of the, you know, the rat race or whatever of the Los Angeles basin. And you know, I travel from here. So, you know, I'm doing, you know, some consulting stuff. I'm doing some stuff here locally. You know, the city that we actually live in, believe it or not, does not have a soccer program.
And you are one. It's crazy.
Yeah,
Kansas is a hotbed.
How is that possible? But I'm still
Bob Dole was a big soccer player, a huge soccer fan. I can't believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
are you growing wheat, by the way? Are you a wheat farmer as well? Is that isn't that like the fun thing to do in Kansas?
I do not get that.
Yeah, I'm entertainment for the farmers here because I know nothing about any of that stuff, and so they'll say, "Hey, Rick, you know, go do this," and then they'll sit and laugh and watch me.
You know, Rick, you grew up in Claremont, and our producer, Ken, it reminded me of him because you said, let kids find their way. Let them find what they want to do. And Ken grew up, University City, and you know, became a skateboarder, grew up next to Tony Hawk. So he became a freestyle champion.
Sure.
So, like I said, your lesson is with all your kids, let them do what they want to do. Let them have their freedom. And well, there's plenty of places, plenty of fields to play in where you are, Rick. I'll tell you that right now.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, Rick, I tell you something. It's been wonderful catching up with you. I hope you'll join us again because we didn't even scratch the surface.
Yeah. Ricky, we need a part two. We definitely need a part two.
Hey, I would enjoy it. I got to tell you, by the way, it is so much fun. It's also refreshing to have you two guys because you know the game. You know, it's a little creepy to be thinking, okay, they're talking about going to games that I played. And I'm
Ricky,
like, oh, man.
Ricky,
I
was there. Against the Sounders. 77,000 people, my friend. It took me 2 hours to get there from Long Island, but we used to go all the time. Imagine 77,000 people just watch soccer in this country.
But the thing is, it's all about me, and the me is you're making me feel old.
No, we're all old, dude. We're all old. But
that's right,
no one. Mick Jagger has never helicoptered in to see me play. I'll tell you that.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Rick Davis of the Cosmos, the broadcasting of AYSO, an entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur, just an all-around good guy, walking history in American soccer. Thank you so much for blessing us with your presence here on Over the Ball, my friend. Let's do it again.
Rick.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Davey G, how fun was that? Talking to Rick Davis, man. That was awesome.
I could talk to him for hours. Really, just a true hero. I know I say that a lot, but when you talk about an American playing with the Cosmos back in the heyday, holy crap.
And he's so humble and just unaffected by it all. You know, great dad to all those kids. So he turned into a hell of a man. So, and I tell you, a lot of pressure that he seemed to just say like, okay, whoever's yelling at me or instructing me, I'll just take it in and learn, which I think a lot of kids need to learn today.
Oh, man. I would imagine being a fly on the wall in that locker room when you have Canalia, he's not scoring goals, whatever, and he's just being a real bitch, and he's bitch-slapping people.
You know, but Canalia, you know, like I said, I worked his camp, and I watched him yell at me and other people. He was cantankerous, and half the time he was hungover, and he was smoking. You know, he's there with the kids, but, you know, what I always is there's always those guys and the big ego there. But, you know, Rick has talked about Franz Beckenbauer before, and that's like the gentleman and the person who comes over here and they're like, okay, I've had this great career. Now I'm going to turn on this country that doesn't know this game very well. And I'm going to help this young man who's an American and his head's in the right place. He's listening to me. And so, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears, but you got to be a good student.
But the fact that he's an all American boy, red, white, and blue, apple pie, Chevrolet. I mean, then he you take this all American boy and you plant them into Manhattan, where Studio 54 during all the glitz and glamour of the city, Studio 54, all the sex and glitz and glamour, and then you have this guy playing with all these gods of soccer. I mean, you can only imagine what went through this guy's mind.
No, we all were hoping we were him, but it seems like he had a good head on his shoulders. And like I said, I don't care where he was playing. It wasn't the level that it should have been when he had to step onto that field. So he had a hell of a lot to learn. He had a hell of a lot to catch up to. And he did it with dignity, and he represented the American face quite proud. So
absolutely,
we had him on. So
yeah, good job. Right. Thanks again for setting that up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we've had a couple of U.S. men's national team captains on over the last couple of weeks with John Harkes and then Rick Davis. So it's a great game, everybody, and there is a great history here in America, and we don't want you to forget it, and we want to make new history as we move forward. And so a lot of great soccer coming up with the U.S. men's national team in the coming months, Dave. So we'll be covering that right
now.
Oh,
hey, you know what? Hey, Kev, one more thing, actually. One thing I got a real kick out of. Did you see the Real Salt Lake game the other day in the snow?
Snow game.
How awesome was that?
That was unbelievable. And I think the coach, just his name is Tarundolo. Steve Tarundolo was complaining about it. I think Tarundolo played in the game in Columbus when it was snowing.
Oh yeah.
And then when the U.S. won, so I said, you know, it's part of the package. It's part of the package. You have all kinds of weather here in America, and that's part of it. Though it was pretty absurd. It was pretty absurd.
It was fun though. It was fun.
Sure was. Sure was. It was like I've been in many a kick around like that, but not with the high stakes that they were playing under. So, all right, good stuff for Davey G, Dave Gallego. I'm Kevin Flynn, and we'll talk to you next time, everybody, on Over the Ball.
Have comments or questions? Give us a ring or shoot us a text at 727-914-9998. That's 727-914-9998.